Right. Welcome to Radio Gorgeous. It is that time of year when it's Man Week. It comes but once a year, but we're very grateful when it does. And we are welcoming Tommy Barnes, author of Trouble Brewing in the Loire, which is a sequel to A Beer in the Loire. Welcome to Radio Gorgeous, Tommy.
Thank you, Donna. It's a pleasure to be here.
Can you introduce us to the now, I can say, series, the Loire Beer series?
Yes. So in 2015, my partner and I were working office jobs in London. We were both fairly depressed, I think. We didn't enjoy sort of the 9-to-5, the rat race. And so we up sticks and moved to rural France. And started a brewery, a little microbrewery in the barn there. And so the book, the first book's really about starting the brewery, and the second book is a continuation of that. And really all the disasters that unfolded as I tried to learn to brew while already selling beer to the French in the sort of deepest wine country.
Well, it occurs to me that you do like a challenge.
Yeah, I think I just didn't think about it. It's not that I don't like challenges, but I didn't put enough thought into it and deeply regretted it. But actually, not entirely. It was a great experience. So, yeah.
It's not, I think that's that idea, that it's a very romantic idea. We'll move to the beautiful French countryside. And, you know, that is my hellhound. We will discuss your hellhound in a moment. But that is my darling, delicious Ruby, off for a walk and to petrify the world. It's a very romantic notion. But as with all grand gestures and romantic notions, it's not all smoothness and light.
No, I suppose that people often say you're very brave to move out to France and start a brewery, but I think there's two sorts of people that do that. There are brave people who consider all the possibilities and all the things that could go wrong and then just decide to do it anyway. And then there are people who don't really think about it and just assume everything will work out okay. And those people are stupid. And I think my wife was brave and I was probably not. But it was, yeah, I mean, it was a romantic, you know, the idea of going living in France. I remember seeing a documentary about Keith Floyd in his later life. And he was sitting around in the garden of his chateau in the south of France, sipping white wine at sort of 11 in the morning, wearing a big flowery shirt. And I just saw him. I thought that's what I want to be doing. And I think I assumed that's what I would be doing when I moved over to France. But it didn't quite work out like that. It turns out you do have to work really, really hard to start a business, especially in a country that you don't speak the language and a business where you don't actually know how to do that business. And so, yeah, what should have been quite a romantic move turned out to be really hard, really stressful, but ultimately rewarding.
Is it? Well, and you're from a reader's point of view, your misadventures are wildly entertaining. So I'm sorry if it's sort of like pointing and laughing at you, but you have brought it upon yourself. But yeah, and so also for some reason your partner seems to have started collecting animals as I don't know if it's a passion project, as a hobby, but you seem to have collected an inordinate menagerie around you. Tell me about some of those.
I mean, I thought it was something to do with her pregnancy cravings. It started when my wife was pregnant with our first child. In fact, the day she went into labor, two sheep arrived. And I thought it may be also some kind of biblical sign, but I could never quite worked out what it was. But from then on, even when she wasn't pregnant, animals continued to arrive. We got 2 miniature goats, a miniature horse, several chickens, 2 dogs. We got budgies, rabbits. I'm trying to think if I've left anything out. Fish. It was a sort of a never-ending rotation of bad-tempered animals. None of them had nice characters. And I, you know, people sometimes say that I'm projecting onto them, but I don't know. I think we were just unlucky. The worst, I mean, really, we started off with these 2 dogs, these 2 puppies, Bert and Louie. And I mean, they were just a nightmare. They chewed through chair legs and things like that. And you'd sit on chairs and they just collapse underneath you. But Bert was really my nemesis. He became my sort of long-term companion. I took him everywhere with me to markets and when I was going and selling beer. And he really spent his entire life trying to ruin my life. And, he's still doing that. We've sent him away at the moment to my cousins, but I can still feel his presence. You know, I still have to look over my shoulder.
He's plotting. Yeah. I'm pretty sure. I'm sure yeah. He's plotting for his return.
Yeah, I'll tell you a story about Bert, really, which really highlights his sort of his evil genius. When I first moved to France, I was doing the gardens of second homeowners. So I was mowing their lawns and things. And I'd take Bert with me, as I say, to try and build bridges. And, you know, I just wanted him to like me, really. And he would go and do poos just up in front of the lawnmower. So that as I was pushing the lawnmower along, I would run over one of his poos and it would just splatter me in dog turd, which was awful. And he did it more than once. He was definitely doing it deliberately. But then this really highlights his sort of his criminal mind. He started pretending to do poos in the distance so that I wasn't exactly sure where they were. So then I would just spend hours circling this lawn, knowing that at some point there was this sort of bomb that I was going to run over. And it was, you know, the anxiety was off the scale. It was awful. I was crumbling. And he hadn't actually done one, you know. He was just playing with me. He was in my head. So I mean, Bert was the, you know, and remains the biggest problem in my life. But I mean, the miniature horse, he would bite me on the shins, and they were always escaping, these animals. I got a phone call from. Sorry.
Because, and also, I mean, despite the romantic notion of the French country idyll, it's quite a conservative society and quite an organized one. And quite, people do like the same things at the same time on the same days. And there's your riotous animals running amok in the village.
Absolutely. My neighbor, Monsieur Richard, who I love dearly, was, I mean, he'd mastered life. Everything he did was perfection. His garden, he had this enormous vegetable garden, which was, you know, laid out with laser precision. And he had a perfectly trained dog. His house was immaculate. Everything he did, you know, was carefully planned and perfectly executed. And then we turned up. And as I say, like, I mean, I got a phone call from the mayor once saying that, our miniature goat was in the mayor's office, so I had to run down to the village and run around trying to catch this miniature goat that was terrorizing the village. But it was actually a great way to meet people, because most of the village came out to help. By the end of it, we had this posse trying to round up a little miniature goat. I think really you can get away with a lot as a bumbling Englishman in France. You know, they would never have forgiven what we did if we were French. We'd have been shunned from society. But instead, they just assume that all English people are like me. So I've done a tremendous damage to the English reputation, but for personally, we got away with it. It helped us a lot.
Yes, to be able to act the buffoon is exactly, helpful, yeah, in certain situations, even if you're not acting.
Yes, exactly.
On the other hand, I assume it doesn't help beer brewing.
No, it always seemed to happen during a beer, a brew, which is, and you know, there are various critical points when you're brewing a beer and then if you're suddenly called out to catch an errant goat, you know, halfway through, it's not ideal. fairly certain Heineken and people like that don't have similar problems. I remember we had a wasp nest in the brewery at one point, which I couldn't get rid of. And so eventually I had to just navigate. There was like a flight path of wasps going in and out of the brewery, and I just had to continue like ducking under these wasps to make the brews. The beer, the thing about the beer is I moved over there, started a brewery, and then decided to learn how to make beer, which anybody would probably spot the flaw in that plan. I started off with a little 25 litre brewery and went down to the local market and sold my beers there. And then I got a slightly bigger brewery. But there's so many things that can go wrong with beer and brewing. And most of them did with me. I think of highlights were I made a beer that tasted of bin, which was a first, I think. So I was breaking new ground in that respect. There were terrible times, you know. I mean, I laugh about it now, but actually, really, when the beer was going badly, when we had problems making good beer, it was the pressure was immense, because by that stage the family depended on it. You know, that was our income at the brewery. So it became
a lot less romantic, and it sounds quite desperate, because also at the same time you don't want to worry your partner. You've got two very young children. And it's all resting on you. And you did, you know, the good man thing. You just kept it bottled up inside and went slowly bananas.
I did exactly. I was a total cliche. This is the sort of thing where you get in too far that it's too embarrassing to really explain how difficult it is and how bad the problems are. So that then instead of just coming clean, you just try and dig your way out of it on your own, which is really a terrible idea.
It is the same reason why people stay in cults for so long.
Is it?
So I'm just saying, it's that much of a success rate on that strategy.
Yeah, it's a sort of shame shame and embarrassment. I found someone to talk to. I had a friend called Fred, who was a local wine producer. He's up on the hill, and he didn't speak any English, Fred. And I didn't really speak great French. So I realized I could go there and tell him all my problems. And he had no idea what I was talking about. And there was no judgment. There were no sort of hard truths to face up to or anything. All he did was just bring out another bottle of sparkling wine. And that was it. So, he was my counselor, really, Fred.
So that's excellent therapy. Not only are you not paying for it, but you get paid. You're being entertained with bubbly. Fantastic.
I always felt wonderful after speaking to Fred. Yeah.
A session with Fred.
Yeah, session with Fred. Yes, exactly.
Like we all need Fred in our lives. But yeah. Also talk to me about, I mean, because it does, again, the sort of romantic notions in the face of French bureaucracy, many have crumbled in the face of the red tape that entails, especially with the business. But then also Brexit came along. So how did that affect you guys as well? I mean, that was a bit of a thud.
Yeah, Brexit was awful, really, for us, because it was the not knowing, really, which I think, you know, is one of the worst things, isn't it? You know, we just it was 4 years they dragged it out for. And we didn't know if we would be allowed to continue our business in France. We had two children by that stage born in France and in the French schools. And we weren't sure if we would suddenly be forced to take them out of the schools or have to pay. You know, we couldn't afford to pay for school care or healthcare. So I think, even though it eventually played out that Brexit wasn't a great problem for us, we could have stayed in the country. It was 4 years of anxiety on top of everything else, really. Just something, you know, always at the back of your mind, always eating away at you that you couldn't really ever settle. It was terrible. We had quite a few English friends out there, and it was worse for lots of people. Lots of people, you know, would have been in real trouble if they'd had to have gone home. So, collectively, it was very difficult for for the expats. There were still people that were expats who were voting for Brexit, which I never quite understood. You know, they were voting for their own downfall, really. But I don't know. Yeah,
it's inexplicable to me. However, its effect on everyone else, because then, you know, it's also, I mean, I'm American, my husband's English, and I found it, you know, when I moved here with a 6-month-old, and I found early motherhood like incredibly isolating. And then I was fooled into a sort of false sense of fluency when I moved here, thinking that just because I spoke English, you know, then that was enough. But I didn't know how anything worked, because it's a completely different school system, healthcare system. I didn't know where you bought anything, because, you know, we put things in different stores. Like, you know, obviously that's at the, you know, at the hardware store, that's where you buy a pan, you know, where it's like, you know what I mean? And so I didn't know where anything was, how anything worked. And then the English reserve, like, I was just like, I was not born with this embarrassment gene. I don't know what you're talking about. Why are you embarrassed? Because I'm feeling something. Like, it just, I just, you know, like, you don't have to be embarrassed for me. I'm not embarrassed, but they jump in and get embarrassed for you. But so I imagine, like, since you're both English and having a young family and, you know, not being, you know, perfectly fluent in language, it's really isolating. And then, you know, on top of it, you're not telling your partner that, like, you are killing your business and you don't even know how and why, you know, I mean, hard times.
Yeah, hard times. Yeah, all of those things, really. And then, you know, multiplied by the fact we couldn't speak the language. Not only was it a different culture, but trying to communicate was reasonable. But as, yeah, we had very similar experiences with shops and things. They have something called parapharmacies in France, which really for years confused us. They're fake pharmacies. They're like pharmacies that don't sell. They sell sort of skin products and things like that. They don't sell anything you actually need from a pharmacy, you know. For my wife, I think, well, you know, eventually we moved back to the UK, I think, because it was too isolating. And with COVID coming along, suddenly we couldn't have family coming over. And at that point, yeah, it became too much. Rose, it was one of those things. I was so deep trying to fix my beer that it took me too long really to notice that my wife was wasn't happy there. But you know, eventually I realized this, and we moved back to the UK. We're currently in Cornwall, which is it's got similar challenges, actually. It's also a different culture.
Yes, the Cornish culture.
They're very nice, the Cornish. Nothing bad to say about the Cornish.
Anyway, so I got the feeling, and perhaps I'm wrong, but that all of your sort of stand-up comedy muscles were sort of flexed and put into your book, and using your own experience, because as you say, you laugh about it now and you can see the funny parts of it, you know, and see that it is actually, despite having had to live through it, it's useful material. So do you have any plans to go back to stand-up comedy, or are you going to keep writing?
Oh, I'll keep writing. I think I did stand-up comedy for maybe 5 years, and I was sort of around the open mics in London, and then really by the time I finished, I was doing like the lowest rank spots in comedy clubs, just in sort of satellite towns around London. But the truth was, I was always a better writer than a performer, I think. You know, I never really had the stage presence to really succeed as a comedian. But whereas writing, I love, and so I think I'll stick to the writing. Probably I might do the odd open mic for fun, I think. But What I realized about the book was it became an insurance policy against the brewery, because the worse the brewing went and the more disasters, the funnier the book would be. And so I actually, you know, what wasn't by design, but actually I did realize it's quite a smart thing to do, to sort of write the book alongside it. People tell me the book's very funny, which tells you how the brewing went, I think, how successful the business was.
I put it all down to Bert. It was Bert's undermining.
Yeah, absolutely.
Well, it also, I mean, I think your proven ground at stand-up comedy proved that you were at least a glutton for punishment anyways. As much as you dished out, you could take.
Yeah, well, yes, yeah, it does prepare you. I think, I mean, there's nothing like doing stand-up comedy, really, for seeing who you are and learning about yourself, I think. The book, I think the book is about, to some degree, about self-discovery, and not necessarily in a good way. You know, I think self-discovery is normally seen as quite a positive thing, and I suppose eventually it is. It's a good thing, but sometimes there are things you don't want to discover about yourself. You know, and I think it is about that as well. The book.
Yes, and I think it's a very honest book. You know, I mean, in fact, yes, it is funny and it is told in a funny way, but at the same time, I think you're very honest about the dark places you went, you know. And I think that's actually, to package it in a funny way is a much better delivery method, if you will.
Yeah.
And yeah, well, and it adds a lot of warmth to something that would just be funny. It adds a lot of humanity and warmth. You know, so you put, I felt like you put a lot of yourself into the book.
Thank you. My main objective was to make it funny. Really, that's really everything I do, I try and make it funny. There's probably various awful psychological reasons for that. Sort of hiding.
Desperate to be liked.
I'm not going to delve into that, but yeah, that was my main hope, was to make it funny. But I did realise that I might have slightly strayed from my original path when my publishers came back to me after reading the first draft and said, "We really like the book, but we're going to have to change the blurb to reflect the mental health side of things." And I was like, "Oh right, I didn't realise I'd done that." But yeah, but you know, it was funny. So fine. I wrote about what happened. You know, so that's that. I mean.
Well, I very much look forward to the next installment, and I can highly recommend getting, I think people should get both of them and send them as Christmas presents. They make very nice Christmas presents for anyone who likes beer.
Yes. Yeah.
And laughing and dogs.
And I go quite into speed bumps as well at one point. So if you're into a detailed discussion about French speed bumps, then also.
Meditations on speed bumps and their spiritual qualities.
Yeah.
The celestial heights of certain speed bumps.
Yeah. Obviously not much was happening at that point in my life, I think. You have to resort to speed bumps. What else? Anyway. I cover pets getting possessed by dead royals as well, which is again, it's probably a market for that somewhere. I don't know.
Well, it's very on trend. Diana's everywhere, and she does come back. You know, there's Spencer out, there's the Crown, and so I do think that that's a particular market for any Princess Di fans. Does feature. there's a visitation.
Yeah.
We are being cryptic, but we're being cryptic on purpose. So that people are lured in to buy the book. Yeah,
exactly.
Anyway. Yeah. Well, Tommy, thank you so much for coming on to Radio Gorgeous and brightening up our man week. We always love having our men on once a year. Never more, never less. And that I'm going to...